Okay, so today I have Davi Ottenheimer with me, and we are talking about drone hacking. So, previous in our series on drones, on autonomous robotics, whatever, we've talked about it politically, we've talked about it, its effect on society. We've never talked about it in terms of technical, on the technical side of it. Particularly, we were sort of interested in sort of merging our series on hacking and InfoSec with drones. I mean, drones are here to stay. They're not going away. They're, equally a tool and a toy. So we wanted to sort of get somebody on the show to sort of walk us through, what does hacking a drone look like? What are the examples? What are the methods? So here we are. So I want to start off with, and I think everybody that's been on the show talking about drones gives us a different history and their different view of drones. So I was sort of curious if you could just walk us through what you consider to be the history of drone usage and sort of, the sort of rise of robotics.
Wow. All right. Well, let me give a first personal anecdote about my own short history of drones in my life. I mean, in the early, I don't want to date myself, but in the early 70s, my grandfather was an electrical engineer and he had been doing a lot of work for a very long time back into the, I'm not even sure, 1930s maybe. In fact, after he passed away, I went through his library and found books on drones and electrical, remote control long time ago. So in the 70s, I was playing with these machines he was working on, and they inevitably failed. He was constantly hacking on them, and then my brother as well. And I had my own first drone, if you will. I had remote control cars and planes and so forth by the 80s, and was taking them apart and putting them together. And they were always failures, because the limitations of power back then were pretty severe. Batteries were terrible, and just the components we worked with. Today, it's a completely different story. But overall, I think if you go back in history, I haven't done this, and even though my background is actually in history, my degrees are in history, I haven't gone into a deep research mode into figuring out where they came from. But I would suspect that we have evidence of drones as far back as people have had any technology, because being able to control flight, for example, the boomerang is essentially a concept where it's sent into flight and then it returns, and you have some way of manipulating it or maneuvering it. But remotely controlling it was only advanced with, I believe it was an Italian invention, if I remember correctly. Like I said, I haven't gotten into it in great depth, but Americans took credit for it. Tesla, in fact, probably was given most credit for inventing the electrical remote control. But he invented it about the same time as an Italian dude. And I don't think Tesla was very bold. He was pretty modest. So I think he even gave credit to that Italian guy.
Interesting. So I want to sort of discuss evaluating the drone as an attack surface. So this is a conversation about hacking. So I'm sort of curious, when you come to a drone, when you come to a Parrot drone, what are you thinking? What is sort of your thoughts on evaluating this robot as, what are the attack surfaces? How do you, approach vulnerability development? What is sort of the intellectual and theoretical path to this?
Well, from a strictly engineering standpoint, it's all about failure rates. So you're looking at what are the most common causes of failure. And when you're attacking them, I guess I should give a disclosure. I'm basically a white hat. I mean, I don't do any sort of offensive attack consulting. I always do defensive, and I'm always trying to protect things. But that being said, when people are attacking you, you have the right to attack in response and self-defense. And so a lot of what attackers do is they reverse engineer or they go backwards through failure information. And that's exactly the same thing you do when you're defending, is you try to figure out where you've had the failures. So when you're pulling apart any kind of drone and any kind of really any kind of device at all, you really want to understand it better, its weaknesses, and improve or attack those weaknesses. You're going to find several common areas. They seem to repeat over time. For example, communication loss. You mentioned already on tweets and so forth, people talk a lot about it. Communication loss actually is only a little bit over 10% of the failure rate. It's about 15% of failure rate, according to the Department of Defense and the studies they're doing of their drones, their most advanced drones with the most advanced technology communicating with them. The greater concern is actually power loss. Between power loss and pilot error or control loss, not understanding what to do, you get about 60% of causes of failure. So One of the funny things about being an attacker also, I think, is that if you're trying to attack something, you look for a weakness which you can exploit, which would increase those percentages. You don't lock yourself into those percentages. And as a defender, of course, you're trying to reduce those percentages. You know, why is power loss such a huge issue? You look at Facebook's initiative, for example, and they're looking at solar drones because they want to provide service, internet service. And the only way to keep them up long enough to provide internet service is to have them powered off something which doesn't require landing and taking off, which should reduce their failure rates as well, because that launching and landing is a huge cause of failure. So, you know, basically what I'm saying is, if you have somebody who's pushing an agenda which is for good and they're trying to figure out ways to reduce cost of operations, it feeds directly into your attack defense understanding.
So, I mean, within the communications versus power loss, I mean, it seems like what's being exploited and what can be exploited would focus on communications. I mean, what is, what are the vectors on the on a drone that are most prone to being exploited by an adversary, by an attacker? I mean, it seems like exploiting the battery or exploiting a power source might be more difficult than, attacking a wireless network or attacking a GSM network or, Wi-Fi or GSM or satellite. So in that sense, what are the most commonly exploited, attack paths for a drone?
Fair enough. I think I can agree with you in some part, because I think at face value, it seems hard to exploit those things that are causing the most failure. But just let me say first, you know, in 2011, when they had a crash of a Predator B because of a clogged oil filter, it immediately made me think about clogging drones, dust and other things which would cause them, or even visibility. Pilot error that we've seen, one of them crashed, I think it was 2006, crashed into the side of a hill. How do you disorient the pilots so that they think they're flying high when they're not? You know, how do you get them to make an optical error and not rely or believe that their instruments are false? Same sort of things you would do to a human in a plane, essentially, the same sort of things that cause failure. But anyway, setting those aside, let's say we're not trying to figure out that threat model. The communication loss is pretty key, because so many things get in the way of communication. Obviously, you have moisture, humidity, and things like that that seem to play an effect. Line of sight, trees apparently have an effect. There are all kinds of weird things that we've been finding that cause communication loss. And again, if you go into communities like the remote control pilots and remote control helicopter guys, they've been doing this forever, and you notice when they fly them, they tend not to lose line of sight, especially for landing and takeoff. So communication in a broader sense is not just wireless. It's actually visual communication with the drone. You probably find now that people who want to launch very expensive drones will have one person, you know, on site launching them in line of sight so they can see them landing and taking off, because it's so difficult to do. And then another person takes over the communication in a different place, wirelessly, to manage them during flight. So now you have a question of, how do you intercept that communication wirelessly? Or, scary enough, how do you intercept the operator in their facility because it's remote, right? They're disconnected now. You don't have to show up. You just have to find out a way to intercept between anything in between that Predator and its ground control unit.
Interesting.
So you can feed the Predator, I mean, I shouldn't say Predator, you could feed the drone bogus information. And for example, you can take over the connection and it'll hone into you. You can disconnect it from what it's relying upon to make decisions, which would be the human or any sort of satellite or GPS. So threat modeling is basically, how do you get in between all the things it needs in order to make a successful mission? And then the other way too, how do you get in between it and the ground, so the ground is making control calls based on faulty information?
Interesting. So, to sort of develop this threat model further, how would you factor in humans? Just, if sort of pilot error and is playing such a sort of large role in being able to destroy and sort of, wreck these robots, I mean, as an attacker and as a defender, how do you factor in, the human element? Is it just a matter of, being able to defend against social engineering attacks, or is there sort of a deeper sort of need for security in this case? Or
It's
reckon, oh,
actually
go ahead.
what's the same as any any insider threat type issue. I mean, if you look at it at scale, let's say Amazon and Facebook start launching all these drones for good, and they're doing things that people want. So they're, delivering packages, or they're providing internet from the sky. There may be, in the threat model, there may be an incentive for somebody to do something which is counter to those, or maybe they're just disgruntled, or maybe they're upset. So what you essentially have is people sitting in a room who are controlling missiles in some sense. I mean, there is a case where, a predator was actually going after a guy, ran out of missiles, and they literally converted the predator into a destruction device. And if you look at the FAA ruling so far, they seem to emphasize very, very heavily, you cannot fly drones near people. So there's a certain height. Basically, they don't want them to run into other flying objects because that would cause a crash and kill people. They don't want them to be run over populated areas because they can fail and crash and kill people. So the idea of, what is the human risk is tied to what can you do with these things? And why would somebody want to be in control of a drone? Why would they be inside that control center? And what would you do to turn them or get them to do something that maybe they don't even want to do, but you want them to do? How do you convince them to act in a way that's malicious or mischievous?
So I think the most famous case of drone hacking has been Skyjack. So I forget his name. I should have written it down, but he basically wrote a program
Sammy.
that.
Yeah, I know Sammy.
Yeah. So I mean, walk us through Skyjack as sort of. I mean, would you consider it A to be sort of a case study in drone-based malicious software, I guess. But I mean. Walk us through what Skyjack is and how it works.
Well, I have a tendency to be frank, so I'll just go ahead and do it here too. I think it was a publicity stunt. I think it was a weak and poorly written attempt. Sammy knows how to grab attention, and so he wrote something that grabbed the media's attention. And it's really, from my perspective, I immediately found flaws in the script. And I told him. So if you go and look at Skyjack, you'll see credit to me for ignore drones. We've skyjacked before. Because basically his program was, I'll send up a drone, I'll intercept the communication channel with my drone, and by taking over that drone, then I'll be able to tell it what I want. So the threat model makes sense. Okay, you're intercepting the communication channel and you're now in control of that drone. What didn't make sense was the way he wrote it was so sloppy and quick. It obviously didn't check to see if they've taken over a drone before. So if you've taken over a drone, then it would try to take over that drone again and again and again. And it, so right away I saw, okay, there's some logic error here. But the funny part for me was when I contacted Sammy and I said, hey, I found a bug. Do you want me to do like full disclosure publicly, or do you want me to like keep it private? He was like, oh my God, keep it private. Everything you find, just let me know. Don't tell anybody else. And he's probably best known for publicly disclosing bugs. He was like, for everybody else, disclose their bugs publicly. So I'm, like I said, I'm pretty frank, and I'm pretty down on like the publicity stunt of this. I think it was good in the sense that it raised awareness. I mean, don't get me wrong, we need to talk about these things, but I think people should have a little more critical view of some of this stuff. Let me give you another example. There's no reason to put a drone up to take a drone down. That's sloppy and expensive, because this is what my presentation was meant to be at Infiltrate and CANSEC West. They didn't accept it, but who knows what reason. But I basically thought it strange that you would send up a drone to take a drone down, because I would take the drone down that was trying to attack my drones. And that was what the presentation was. I had written a way to find the skyjacked drones and kill them. Not only that, but I found a very reliable way that he couldn't probably prevent. So every time Sammy would launch one of his drones to intercept mine, I would be taking his out before he had a chance to do anything. And so that's a classic mistake made by attackers, is they think they found one small flaw, and so they launch something which is full of flaws, and you can just knock them out.
Then let me ask you maybe a more sort of abstract question. Then what is this? Is there a strategy or can there be a strategy behind drone hacking? I mean, if you as a defender, were so quick to sort of point out an error in an attacker's script and then be able to adapt against it, walk us through then, a strategy of drone hacking. Is it similar to a strategy of, defending information, defending networks, or how is it different? Walk us through it then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you definitely have a, I guess you don't have to, but you should use a rigorous method of trying to ensure availability. I mean, it's the classic case of you need confidentiality information because you don't want people to be able to break into your communication channels. You want integrity of information because you don't want to have bad data sending you into a hillside, and you don't want to have a loss of availability. So basically, if your engine dies, so you take your drones and you hack them on those three ancient CIA levels, and you can quickly find flaws and try to reduce them. I'm pretty bullish on the fact that people are using drones illegally and they're here to stay. So I'm starting to look at ways that, municipalities can defend themselves. I think Colorado just got a law turned voted down, and it seems like it was a bit of a joke. It was a tongue in cheek, but they were trying to pass a law that said anyone in the town that saw a drone flying over would legally be allowed three shots to bring it down, and there would be money too. It was like a bounty program. So you have to plan for these sorts of things, right? You have to plan for if you're in a populated area and people don't like your drone, how do you keep it flying and in the sky? How do you avoid, interception? How do you avoid collision? How do you avoid error? Like I said, one way that fixed this so far has been line of sight as a form of communication. So once they figured out that drones were very difficult to land and take off from remote, you can't really do it very well. They put people out on site to do it so they could see it.
So then, I want to sort of transition into more theoretical questions. Not really super abstract theory, but would you consider Skyjack to be a form of malware then? I mean, is it fair to call Skyjack a form of sort of malware that whose target is a drone? I mean, is that a fair definition? Is that a correct definition? How would you categorize sort of Skyjack?
I think in a very abstract sense, it could be malware. But really, for me, malware is more like if Skyjack were able to infect the drone and make it do things it didn't want to do, it would be more like malware because it's essentially hijacking drones. It's meant to go up, take over a drone. And like I say, there's a whole number of reasons why that would be very prone to failure and probably not work very reliably. But I've designed already a system where I can scan the skies and take down drones I don't want to be in the air, or I can cause failure rates to increase in the communication channel. And that still isn't at the level of malware. I think we need to get, if you want to talk about malware, we're talking about, the explosion of drones, and you're able to infect those drones in some way and so that they behave in ways they're not supposed to. For example, they crash into the ocean. So malware to me would be like, I don't know if you just saw, but in February, another predator got sent into the ocean. This goes back to the FAA again. They're very worried about predators being anywhere close to human populations when they go down, or any drone for that matter. So they send it off into like no man's land and crash it so that it doesn't cause any casualties. And they say, okay, that's a safety mode. So malware would really be something like that. It would go into all these drones at launch. Example, in San Francisco, there are a lot of journalists who are launching drones and doing things. Even Twitter has launched a drone and it is illegally flying it over the city and taking pictures of people and putting it in areas that it would be dangerous if it crashed. And malware would simply go up and say, if I see a drone in a populated area, I will reprogram it or give it control logic to send it out to Golden Gate and crash in the ocean. That would be, to me, that would be more like malware.
Then,
Or crash into people. I mean, you could do terrible things with it too. You could force those things to like land in populated areas.
interesting. So, I mean, in that sense, I mean, if we were to compare a drone, hacking drones with hacking computer networks, I mean, it seems like on a computer network, the highest goal you want is persistence, being able to sit on somebody's system, collect information, disrupt, business, whatever, but it almost seems like the way that you've discussed drones is that the highest goal for an attacker is to crash a drone. So, I mean, is there the possibility to create persistence that an adversary would potentially compromise a drone so much that, they might not be able to control the drone, but be able to, be a second pair of eyes on the information that it creates or that it sends back to its controller?
Yeah, we're actually shifting now to models where people fly multiple drones and then they use control software because they can't possibly manage them all. So they automate using an iPad or a PC. So they'll basically take software load that software with whatever configurations they want, waypoints, then load all the drones and then send them up. So for example, you'll send 10 drones up. They all have missions to go out and photograph certain areas, come back, download that data. So in a sense, malware really wouldn't have to target the drones itself, and because the brains of the drones are very small. They may get bigger and more sophisticated, but ultimately they need connection to home because they can't, we really don't have any artificial intelligence capability, even in our biggest systems. It'll be a while before we get them into the little ones. They can't do avoidance, for example. They can do some heat. But I think Israel recently shot down a drone, and they even said they couldn't get the thermal imaging to work properly, so they had to have like line of sight. And so the pilot was able to force the missile to hit the drone. Even though it had thermal, it still had to have some human control. So we're ways away from infecting drones to being that powerful. But if we infect the control systems, the people, like I said before, in the operation center, or the software that's used to set waypoints and determine what pictures are taken and how many, that's a completely different story. That can be very dangerous because, I mean, you could literally send them off, take a bunch of pictures they're not supposed to, and download that data. And the person who thought they were going to do some like innocent work now is suddenly involved in some dangerous surveillance work.
So then if we were to say, you know, lineup, drone control systems, you know, even the software used to set waypoints, it almost seems like what you're arguing is that the control systems are the most vulnerable, that really if somebody were to create malware or to target these systems, they wouldn't necessarily target the bot. They would target, you know, the human control part, the control system.
Well, the threat model is like, what are you trying to achieve? If you're sending up, let's say, 10 or maybe even 50 drones to sample air quality, and your objective is to cause chaos, you're going to send all those drones into the ground, and you're going to start making them land in the street and things around people. I mean, but that might not be your objective. Maybe your objective is you're a power company and you want to prove that you're not polluting the air. So then you infect somewhere in the data channel the quality of those samples. So that can be at the endpoint. It can be in telling the drones where to go so they sample from the wrong area. They don't sample actual pollution. They sample like clean ocean air. So if you're talking about an integrity issue, then it's a completely different, you know, threat modeling exercise.
So I want to get to this idea that we've been talking about companies and individuals mostly, or I feel like we've been talking about companies and individuals. What happens when a state, you know, can you, you know, let me start off this way. Can you walk us through examples where a state drone, a drone controlled by the United States, China, Israel, whomever, has been hacked? Because I think in our research for this show, I could only think of one example, and that was in Iraq. And that it was basically basically Iraqi surgeons were able to use a tool, you know, that you would use to borrow your neighbor's Wi-Fi, and were able to sort of look at the visual feed of what was, you know, what the drone was seeing, and then what it was transmitting back to its controller. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, are there examples of people hacking sort of state-funded and, you know, state-created drones? And is that sort of, is this something that we should expect in the sense of, you know, how these robots will be developed, how these robots will be deployed at the level of the nation state?
Well, I'm tempted to say if you take a broad enough definition of drone, then there are many examples, maybe even hundreds of thousands of examples of nation states sending them into battle and sending them places. But if you take a very narrow definition of drone and just say it's an unmanned aerial vehicle of a certain capacity. I mean, the latest example, I think, was a couple of days ago, was North Korean drones crashing in South Korea. And it's kind of funny to look at them because people are saying, oh, these look like toys. And it makes me wonder, like, maybe they are toys. Maybe actually somebody in North Korea was actually literally just fooling around with the drone and they had that capability. But most people would say not the average person would have that. It has to be state-sponsored. There's no way for someone to build a drone that can fly over Seoul, you know, South Korea, and so forth. And the drones themselves were camouflaged. They were painted to be invisible, which is unusual for any kind of hobbyist. Usually they want to see the things because they enjoy watching them. So it just depends, I guess, on the objective. And the other example that comes to mind, which I'm pretty sure has been documented, is the interception of a communication channel in Iraq. Maybe it was Afghanistan. And the drone crashed, unmarked drone. And as far as I know, that the the story there was that the communication channel was interrupted and there was no fail-safe. So when drones lose their communication channel, in the past they used to just fly in a circle until they ran out of fuel and then they'd crash. I think that's probably what happened there. And so that changed a lot of things. I think people now build a fail-safe to where if it loses its communication channel, it just goes home, or it has some place it goes, a safe zone that it can land, which a known safe spot to return to. So that's the other example, I think, which is pretty well documented as a nation state attack. Other than that, no, I haven't seen a lot of examples. Israel has talked about shifting their entire strategy for their pilots to intercepting drones because the threat of drone is far higher than from Hezbollah, for example, than it is for actual warplanes. They're less likely to launch an F-14 given the cost and the complexity of the piloting and so forth. But they'll launch a drone with missiles. It's much easier for them to learn those and fly them and so forth. And even if they're unsuccessful, they still can have an impact, right? They might not hit their target, but they'd still land in a populated area and do damage. So you're seeing Israel publicly talk about how they're using Python and they're using, I think I tweeted about one this morning that they fired the missile and it was able to do 90 Gs or something like that. They said the missile had to turn basically on a rough angle to intercept the drone. So they're getting really good at doing some amazing things. And missiles themselves, in a sense, are drones. So that's why I'm saying if you go with a very broad definition, you can find many, many examples of drone-like nation-state behavior.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, this sort of bugs me. I'm in DC, and then I'm going between, where I am in the city, and between that space, public space. So I'm just in the metro. I see ads for drones, enduring innovation, and there's a gorgeous picture of a global hawk staring at the train, and then there's also pictures of F-35s. And so my question is, is there a sort of tension between going from explicitly manned systems like the F-35, to sort of transitioning to unmanned systems? I mean, is there advantages? Is there tensions? I mean, it almost seems like we're in this sort of, transition period where, nation states are still investing in F-35s, F-22s, whatever, really fancy manned planes. But at the same time, there's this sort of ascendance of, unmanned weaponry and sort of, not necessarily missiles, but like drones and sort of UAVs. But I mean, in your research, I mean, is there a sort of tension between those two sort of systems?
Well, early in my life, I was a student of political science, international relations, international history. And that question just brings me back to what really I think there's a question hidden there, which is there tension between people who fly planes and drop bombs, the fog of war effect, if you will, and then go home, and between those who actually are on the ground interacting with other people and shooting them face to face? Is there a difference between those who have for the longest time held a sort of reputation for being the best for doing things that are essentially remote death? And I noticed a shift in just in the ascendancy of power. Civilians who are working with the military seem to be working more with the Navy now than ever before. I'm not sure why I noticed this, but I just started to realize that there were more and more admirals doing important work, and it seemed like the Air Force guys were getting less and less relevance in the discussion. And I asked some of the Navy guys why this is so, retired who are out of the service already. And they actually said it's because of the drones. They said because being a Top Gun pilot no longer has the same cachet. It's no longer as essential. And in fact, it's sort of brought back to the roots, the central question, which is if you're sitting in a cockpit, whether that cockpit really is a lounge chair in Vegas or whether it's in the air flying and you're dropping bombs, I mean, you're removed from the actual theater of combat. I mean, dogfighting, of course, is a different story, but we're really talking about things that are remotely killing people. So it's more like artillery than it is hand-to-hand or commanding large numbers of people to intercept other people. So I'm not an expert in this space, but I have noticed a shift, and I have asked a few people, and they've confirmed that drones are having a major impact on the way that the forces are being treated and how the future of the military is being decided. I think it's a very real issue.
But
I mean, boats aren't immune either. We're going to have drone boats, of course. We already do, so we can send in, boats that people are on. You can see this a lot actually with the forces that go insertions, and they do some the more dangerous behind the scenes work. The black helicopter, black ops stuff, type stuff. There are boats for that too. So a lot of those could be drone based with only one or two people. Perfect example is when we used to go into Somalia after we destabilized Somalia and destroyed their government. Again, I'm being a little frank here, but after we didn't stood by while that government was destabilized, we were able to go in and do things that we didn't have to worry about some sovereign authority telling us not to. And we used to fly in and sit on the ground and look to see if our campaigns were successful. So we would, bomb somebody or target somebody we wanted to kill, and then we could send people in to go look through the rubble and see if we did that effectively. And so drones will take over a lot of that, if not all of that, to the point that our intelligence will actually shift, I think, or already has shifted. And we'll be looking more for communication channels to intercept and understand if people are confirming that we've been successful. And then we'll use drones to go in and do the more dangerous, on-site inspections.
So I'm sort of curious, I want to sort of transition a little. So in my conversation with Bob Farley, so he's written a book about abolishing the Air Force, and I think part of our conversation was that sort of drones have democratized airspace. And, what I mean is, not democratized literally that everybody has a vote, but in the sense that, and I think you sort of touched on this, is that being able to fly was a limited, it was limited to a certain group of people, being able to pilot a plane. And now you've had a whole influx and more people are being able to, to fly, to, fly robots and whatnot. I mean, what has this sort of done? I mean, do you think this is a sort of a healthy movement? Or, the idea that, I could go down to Barnes and Noble down the street, buy a $300 parrot, and then, this afternoon could be flying a robot. I mean, what do you see as the larger societal impact?
Democratization is a good way of describing it. I think the intelligence community and the military describe it a different way. They see it as frictionless, and they worry about frictionless things because the barrier to entry is so low. They're describing, for example, malware or any kind of hacking as frictionless combat, and that terrifies them, yeah, because there's no barrier to entry. So if it's very, very expensive to get to a point, either through training or through machinery, then when you go into combat, the person who has the most resources and the most training wins. That's sort of the calculation they've been using for a while. But that obviously historically isn't really what it's about. I was just reading about, I think it was 119 BC, when the Chinese were circling their wagons to fight off the Mongols. They were overwhelmed by huge numbers. And so the Mongols came at them with apparently 80,000 people. This just seems like exaggeration to me, but from what I'm reading, it's like 80,000 people on horses were coming and attacking these several thousand Chinese, and they were able to defend themselves simply by using a little bit of technology and a little bit of smarts. And I think the future really is going to continue what the past has taught us, which is if people are intelligent, then they will find innovative solutions to even overwhelming problems. Even frictionless threats will have trouble if we innovate a little bit and look at why it's frictionless. Maybe we can add some salt in their eye or so forth, sand in their eye. And another thing to consider, I think, is we need to think about society as pressure to prevent things from happening. So it's more of a group effort rather than a highly sophisticated, targeted specialist effort. And there's a balance. I don't think you can go too far either way, because if you over rely on the barrier to entry method where people become super specialized, and it's essentially like the police. I mean, if you rely on somebody becoming a trained police officer who has all the smarts for investigations and so forth to really take care of raising your child, you've lost the balance. You can't use these very expensive methods to provide safety, security, and balance, across the board. You really have to have more social emphasis on what is right and wrong and have people contribute or jump in. It's just not only is it expensive to train Top Gun pilots or Navy SEALs for that matter and put them into battle and have them be successful, but it's prohibitively expensive. You can't end up spending enough money to solve all the problems. So there have to be better solutions. And the frictionless part, the democratization, is actually going to work for us if we use it that way, as opposed to being just a scary thing.
So I want to end the show with sort of, lessons learned. In your research on defending drones and hacking drones and what have you, what are some of the key security lessons? What are, some of the major points that you've learned in this research that, as a security researcher, you could apply to other security problems and to other sort of issues in that, are in InfoSec today?
There are three things. The first two things are things I talk about all the time, which is the future of security, information security as a whole. And I'm the senior director of trust, so actually I should say it's the future of trust. The future of trust is based on two things. One, it's the lack of friction, actually. It's the ability to move things places where they're no longer at risk. So I work all the time with I can move an entire data center 200 kilometers, no problem. Nobody would notice. So if you're attacking my data center A, and I don't want to be attacked at A, I can move to B, and you don't know I'm running out of B anymore. You can't find B. So this frictionless world that we're moving to has some real benefits for trust. So can we get places where people can't find us? So drones, in a sense, which are going to be used for targeting, may not be effective if they can't figure out how to target. The second part is detection, which is we're getting better and better at surveillance in the sense that we can detect threats faster and detect attackers faster. So this is a major, these are the two major points I think that have to be made, because drones are going to be in a world where if things are moving, they have to find them, and you may need more drones to find more things, but it's constantly this race of trying to figure out where things are. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is with detection, how do you create drones that are invisible when you've got so many of them? So the third thing is, given those first two, those trade-offs, those races that we're in for detection, and there are a lot of complications that, of course, privacy is one major complication. Right, learning is actually in a form of surveillance, but learning is okay, as Microsoft has recently said with their software. It's just when learning is called surveillance that we get angry about it. But anyway, so if you set aside those first two, the third is that drone people, the people who are building drones and running drones and even trying to hack drones, are in more of a rush than we're used to. So we take bigger risks. We push them harder. So the example I gave already is where if you run out of missiles, you just crash the drone right into whatever target you had. And you take that loss because, what is the loss? It's money as opposed to a human life. So with space flight, we started with non-manned, because the risk was so high. But once we had established some degree of reliability, we put humans into the spaceships, and but we moved very cautiously and carefully in that phase. And the same with airplanes and so forth. But when we move into drones, you take away that sense of risk, you pull people away, and it becomes remote. Someone pointed this out the other day, like, why is it okay to use drones to kill people, but it's not okay to torture them? Why is the public so upset about the idea of torture? Well, it's because it's a human emotive. You can really relate to that situation, but the drone seems so remote. So the third thing is that people seem to be in a rush, they seem to be in a hurry, and they seem to cut a lot of corners. And that can work to our favor in defense, as well as work against us in terms of attack. People can launch things which are really dangerous, and we have to be very quick to intercept them and figure out where they're at and how to take them down carefully and safely. That's one of the things that's actually what my hacking presentation was going to be, was these are the things that people are doing. These are the ways that we can defend ourselves better. And so hacking drones actually is going to be something that people are going to have to get used to. If you see that Google car coming with its camera trying to film you, it's essentially an automated car with an automated camera. Do you have a way to intercept or defeat that system?
So before we go, we always like to give the guest the last word. Something for the audience to think about, chew on, to think about. So give us, before we go, a last word to think about.
A last word. I've said so much already. I feel like I'm running out of words. Well, I mean, I guess the last word is think about where drones are already in your lives and how you've trusted them so far. Think about how we really have for a very long time relied upon automation and things, and we've trusted some degree of drones in many parts of our lives. So the future isn't shockingly new. We don't have to rush forward towards it. We should learn from our past and learn lessons we've seen already and apply those. So moving forward with caution, I think, is probably the last word. And when I say move forward with caution, I really, I say learn from the past, because the trust, I think, in the future is built upon what we know. And the people that claim that things are sophisticated or too hard to understand, or you should see what I see, but I can't tell you, they're really just insecure. I think ultimately there are two modes of behavior. There's either things we understand or things we don't understand and are learning. And don't be intimidated by the sophisticated crowd.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for
Thank
having me.
you. No problem.